Where's my papers at? Oh, right.
Excuse me. It is Friday, 5 p.m. 90.3 WHPC. WHPC HD is the station. And it's time for American Net Radio. I'm Tom Ryan. I'll be your host for the next hour if you want to have some fun. And with me, my lovely wife and co-host, running the board, Heidi Morales Ryan. Now, for about 4 months, we've been running a series on gospel music, and we just closed that out last Friday. So it's time for us to move on to a new one. And if you were listening, I'll let you know what that was at the time. We are going to be talking about the life and music of Jimi Hendrix. This ought to be interesting. Now, I got to be honest. In the very first show, when we do this stuff, it's a lot of words, a lot of talking. And I'm going to be taking a lot of it from excerpts from books. In particular, I'll be focusing on this incredible book that's simply called Jimmy. I think it was put out by his own, the Hendrix Experience people. It's an amazingly gorgeous book. I don't remember what I paid for it, but it was not inexpensive. And it's great. It's got, there's a lot going on here. Now, I'm going to be flipping pages, so I might end up finding myself getting a little bit confused as I do this, but I'll do my best. Now, also, before we get started, I just want to, what we're going to be talking about mostly today is the early life of Jimmy. And hopefully we're going to get up to a point where we're actually going to be able to play some songs. I might even drop a few in. And Heidi, I might be asking you to maybe take them out of the series that I have the mic placed. I'll let you know. I'll do it on mic. It shouldn't matter. But I know that an awful lot of people have this idea that professional musicians make a lot of money. But the truth is that in 99% of the cases, that simply is not true. Musicians, most musicians, struggle for a living. Even some of the musicians who have label deals and tour work hard for little pay. It all seems so glamorous from afar, but when you're in it, you see it for what it is. Jimi Hendrix started out as a starving sideman, working for minuscule pay and sometimes even sleeping on the street, even when he was recording with well-known artists like the Isley Brothers and Little Richard. So with this show, as we talk about his early life, it may become pretty obvious that musical success does not come easily, if it comes at all. But like I said, I've got a couple of segments here, and as an introduction to Jimi Hendrix, I'll be reading from this book. Just, my God, that's huge. I don't know what else to say except that it's a book called Jimmy. It doesn't even list an author. This is why I think it's from his own Hendrix Experience thing. And it's, God, it's got to be about 8 by 12. It's a monster. But ultimately, what are we talking about if we're going to be talking about the career of Jimi Hendrix? I mean, during the course of just 4 extraordinary years, Jimi Hendrix left an indelible stamp on the world, shaping popular music and culture with his clear ambition and groundbreaking creative impulses. He remains the most innovative guitarist of his or any other era, literally creating the vocabulary of the guitar while redrafting the parameters of electric blues. Though Hendrix could not read or write music, he was a devoted student, fascinated by the wondrous sounds he heard on radio and records. Rooted in the Delta blues of Muddy Waters, Jimmy's intense curiosity propelled him to cast his net even wider, discovering the stylistic elements that informed early rock and roll. Hendrix drew encouragement from greats like Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, and later, the Beatles and Bob Dylan, not to imitate, but to continue on his own path, to create, as he would later describe, an updated modern form
of electric blues. Hendrix came to prominence in a fast-hanging world. While Carnaby Street and swinging London embraced him quickly, America took longer. Hendrix worked diligently, carrying his message and music to a burgeoning youth culture, struggling for racial equality and agonizing over Vietnam. Despite his early tragic death and the turbulent life that preceded it, Jimi Hendrix was not, as his manager, Chas Chandler, would adamantly insist, a tragic figure. He remains, however, an enigma, an innovator frozen forever in time at the age of 27. Friends remember him as a complex, compassionate man who was loyal to those close to him and generous to a fault. Yet music was and would always be first and foremost his true love. Jimmy lived in order to play his guitar, seizing every opportunity to explore its countless possibilities. Hendrix also adored making music with other artists, and his affinity for jamming with fellow musicians was legendary, with impromptu sessions often lasting hours on end. I plan to cover some of those, not the entire jam, but tracks taken from there when they were recorded. Be it a hip Manhattan night spot or a dusty southern roadhouse, Hendrix savored the chance to push himself further, feeding off other musicians, dipping into different styles, and bending them into something utterly new. In fact, jam sessions frequently served as a proving ground for fertile new rhythm patterns he would later refine into formal songs. When he wasn't performing or jamming, Jimmy was recording music, both at home, playing and singing into his hulking reel-to-reel tape deck, and at the studio. Problem with this is this thing goes on forever with different pages. So, in short, Johnny Allen Hendrix was born on November 27th, 1942, to his 17-year-old mother, Lucille, and his father, Al. The couple were married on March 31st, 1942. And Al went to serve in World War II on April 3rd, 1942. 3 days after he gets married, he's sent overseas for World War II. Now, that would have been tough. And this circumstance left Jimmy with a very young and, frankly, ill-equipped mother to be his sole parent. She had no income, and so she moved around a lot, living with girlfriends, and eventually left baby Jimmy to live with her mother. After that, Jimmy ended up being shuttled between caretakers while his father, Al, was serving in the Pacific. While Jimmy was being shuttled around, Al, still on active duty in the Pacific, received a letter from a Mrs. Walls, a stranger to Al, who wrote that she was now looking after his son and that he could come and collect him when he was discharged from the service. I don't know when exactly Lucille got separated from Jimmy, Al recalled. I don't think there was anyone in the Jeter family who was able to take care of Jimmy full time, since Lucille's sister, Dolores, had started having kids of her own. Lucille was still getting her allotment at that time, but she wasn't paying for Jimmy. So I started sending money to Mrs. Walls instead, who didn't know where Lucille was half of the time. Then Mrs. Walls passed away shortly thereafter and left the baby in the care of her sister, Mrs. Champ. Total strangers. Finally discharged in September of 1945, Al set out by train to Berkeley to reclaim his son. Though Mrs. Champ had shown love and compassion for his child, Al never wavered in his desire to take his son back with him to Seattle. "He's what I have been thinking about all these years I was in the service," he explained to Mrs. Champ. Father and son, as you could imagine, spent an awkward week in Berkeley trying to grow familiar with one another. There's so many pictures in this book, turning pages, it takes forever. Back in Seattle, Al immediately set about legally changing his son's name dropping the Johnny Allen that Lucille had chosen without his input and opting for James Marshall Hendrix instead. Al struggled to find work in the war's aftermath. Seattle was no different than any other major urban center across the United States, trying hard to place returning servicemen back into the workforce. The war came long before civil rights, Al explained. It was hard for blacks to get jobs, let alone one with good pay. To help make ends meet, Al and Jimmy moved in with Lucille's sister, Dolores. When Dolores and her children moved into the racially integrated housing project on Yesler Terrace, Al and Jimmy joined them. It was there that Lucille returned to see her husband and son. Al had not seen Lucille since his return from the Army. In fact, he had started divorce proceedings against her as far back as when Jimmy had first been put in the custody of Mrs. Champ, understandably. I asked Lucille about her not taking care of Jimmy, and she said, "Well, I was moving around so much," Al remembered. "My feelings were lukewarm, but I was still attracted to her. I thought I was gone so long, and she was so young when I left." Al would later claim that he was one final payment of $75 away from finalizing the divorce when Lucille asked him to reconsider and take her back. Look at all these. Here we go. Jimmy's words. "My dad was a gardener, and we weren't too rich," Hendrix later remembered. "It got pretty bad in the winter when there wasn't any grass to cut." "There were family troubles between my mother and father," Hendrix admitted. "They used to break up all the time. I used to go to different homes. I stayed mostly at my aunt's and grandmother's. I always had to be ready to go tippy-toeing off to Canada." Ultimately, Lucille left Al and Jimmy and was soon pregnant with another man's child. After giving birth to a son, Leon, Lucille entered into another relationship that resulted in the birth of Joey, the second of Jimmy's half-brothers. Lucille and Al's turbulent relationship finally and officially came to an end in 1951 when they divorced. Al was granted custody of Jimmy. After the divorce, Jimmy and Leon never went to stay with their mother, Al said. She wanted to be around the kids, but she wanted her freedom too. It was like that old saying, you can't have your cake and eat it too. "Mostly, my dad took care of me," Hendrix echoed. "He taught me that I must respect my elders always. I couldn't speak until I was spoken to by grown-ups, so I have always been very quiet. My dad used to say that a fish wouldn't get into trouble if he kept his mouth shut, but I saw a lot of things." As he grew older, Jimmy developed a keen interest in music. When he mined his father's record collection, he discovered artists like Louis Jordan, as well as the unvarnished power of down-home blues. "The first guitarist I was aware of was Muddy Waters," he explained. "I heard one of his records when I was a little boy, and it scared me to death because I heard all of those sounds. Wow, what is that all about? It was great." As a teenager, the unbridled energy and enthusiasm of rock and roll captivated Jimmy. When he saw Elvis Presley perform at Seattle's Six Stadium in 1957, it broadened his horizons, expanded his influences. "I was digging everybody from Billy Butler, who used to play with Bill Doggett, Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, B.B. King, and Elmore James," Hendrix recalled. "But I didn't try to copy anybody. Those are just the people that gave me the feeling to get my own thing together." A battered ukulele Jimmy used for practice soon gave way to a secondhand acoustic guitar that Al purchased for $5 from a family friend. "I learned, all the riffs I could," Hendrix detailed. "I never had any lessons. I learned guitar from records and the radio. I loved my music, man. I'd go out there on the back porch in Seattle because I didn't want to stay in the house all the time, and I'd play the guitar to a Muddy Waters record. You see, I wasn't interested in any other things, just the music." Unable to read music, Jimmy concentrated on studying records and developing his own musical style. Countless hours of solitary practice at home soon led to the chance to perform in public, as rock and roll's infectious popularity created numerous opportunities for struggling local bands. One such band was the Velvetones, the first group with whom Hendrix performed. Jimmy was barely in high school when he took to the stage. "I started looking around for places to play," Hendrix remembered. "My first gig was at an armory, a National Guard place, and we earned 35 cents apiece." Oh, man. See what I'm talking about. We used to play stuff by people like the Coasters. After the Velvetones, Hendrix joined the Rockin' Kings, a new six-piece combo that performed at dances and youth functions. It was so hard for me at first, Hendrix later admitted. I knew about three songs, and when it was time for us to play on stage, I was all shaky, so I had to play behind the curtains. I just couldn't get up in front. Then you get so very discouraged. You hear different bands playing around you, and the guitar player always seems like he's so much better than you are. Most people give up at this point, but it's best not to. Just keep on, just keep on. Sometimes you're going to be so frustrated that you hate the guitar, but all of this is just a part of learning. If you're very stubborn, you can make it. I was 18, Hendrix later said. I didn't have a cent in my pocket. I had no intention of returning to Garfield High School. He had also been classified 1A by the local draft board. The choice before him was to select a service branch and enlist or wait for a draft notification. I figured I would have to go into the Army sooner or later, so I walked into the first recruiting office and I volunteered. Ooh, boy. I volunteered to get it over with, he said, so I could get my music together later on. Let's play a track here, Heidi, just to fill it out, because I think this is kind of worth it. Let's play track three. This is Jimi Hendrix on the guitar. You'll notice that in the background. It's by the Isley Brothers, and the track is called Have You Ever Been Disappointed?
Into his life, some rain was falling. Sometimes I get that feeling, too much is falling in mine. Sometimes I wonder, was I born to suffer? Sometimes I feel I'm only wasting my time. All of the lonely people, hey, yeah. Where do we all come from? If y'all can tell me, I would surely like to know. Driving in my car, on the lonely highway, which exit should I turn off now? Tell me, where should I go? I was born to love. I was born to feel. Ever since I was a child, I felt the things that were real. My daddy taught me to stand up and say what was on my mind. But now my daddy's gone. It seems such a long, long, long time. How many times do we go along with something, with some of the things that we know ain't right, have to be wrong? Sometimes I feel, yeah. Oh, I feel so disappointed. Every little thing that I try looks like it turns out to be in vain. And I turn around and look at my friends and ask them for some kind of understanding. And they say, don't look at me, don't look at me. Oh, how they change. So tell me who do I turn to? Where can I go? Who has the answer? Seems that don't know. Someday I'll find some place where there's love and peace of mind, and wipe all my troubles away. Oh, I'd be so glad to see that day. Gotta keep on searching, and I know I'll find a way. Oh, no more sadness. Oh, no more fears. No more tears. Well, no more sadness. Oh, no more tears. Well, no more heartaches, no more fears.
To go for that track because I think it does a great job of it's more or less playing out what Jimmy's life was like for him at that time, and that's him playing guitar on that track with the Isley Brothers well before he was famous. Now Hendrix did ultimately earn a patch as a member of the famed Army Paratroop Division, but his initial enthusiasm soon waned. He proved to be an unmotivated soldier, disinterested in routine and the rigors of army discipline. I hated the army immediately, Hendrix later admitted. The training was really tough. It was the worst thing I had ever been through. They were always trying to see how much you could take. In addition to disliking the rigor of the army, Hendrix's shy, introverted personality and his preoccupation with his guitar caused many soldiers to view him as odd or distant. However, it was his raw skill as a guitarist that eventually drew the attention of Billy Cox, a fellow soldier and aspiring musician. Born in West Virginia and educated in Pittsburgh, as a youth, Cox had tried his hand with a variety of instruments, including violin, piano, baritone, horn, and trumpet. He fell in love with the electric bass sound established by R&B legend Lloyd Price's band. 2 years older than Hendrix, Cox, too, had enlisted and was stationed at Fort Campbell. One evening in 1961, a heavy rainstorm on the base drove Cox for cover and purely by chance into contact with Jimi Hendrix. I had gone to the Post Theater to watch a movie, remembered Cox, and when we left the theater, it was raining. We all scattered for cover, and me and one of my friends wound up on the doorstep of Service Club No. 1. We heard some guitar coming out of the window that was half raised. I heard something I never heard before, and I told the guy, hey, listen. that's really good guitar playing. He said, don't sound good to me. He left. I went inside and introduced myself. I told Jimmy that I played bass and asked if he would mind if I joined him. In the service clubs, if you showed your military ID card, you could check out all these wonderful instruments. If you had an ID, they would give you a trumpet, saxophone, guitar, bass, whatever you wanted to play. We found out that we had a lot in common musically. Cox and Hendricks became friends, and together with drummer Gary Ferguson, formed the King Casuals. Like other budding groups of this era, the King Casuals developed a stage repertoire chock full of blues and R&B favorites by such favorites as B.B. King and Bobby Blue Bland. I booked some small gigs for us at places like Service Club 1 and Service Club 2 on the bass until we got good, recalled Cox. Then we finally got a job working in the city at the American Legion in Clarksville, Tennessee. Hendricks was honorably discharged in 1962. One morning, I found myself standing outside the gate of Fort Campbell on the Tennessee-Kentucky border with my little duffel bag, Hendricks recalled. In the Army, I'd start to play the guitar very seriously, so I thought all I can do is try to earn money playing the guitar. Cox and Hendricks struggled to make ends meet. With few opportunities in Clarksville, the two chased news of a steady gig in Indianapolis, traveling in Cox's battered car. The job never materialized. Stranded, they subsisted on crackers and shared bowls of chili before mustering enough resources to make their way to Nashville. Tennessee was better to them, and the King Casuals secured a residency at the Club Del Morocco. The group now included Larry Lee, a guitarist and Tennessee State University student who had struck up a friendship with Cox and Hendricks. We were the house band, said Lee. We played four nights a week for $11 a night. Jimmy and Cox moved right next door to the club, sharing a small apartment atop Joyce's House of Glamour on Jefferson Street. By the fall of 1962, the King Casuals had begun to build a small but steady audience at the Club Del Morocco. But Hendricks was eager to move beyond Nashville. He used to say when he was famous he would have 1,000 guitars, Lee remembered. And he said, when I get famous, not if. In early 1962, he parted ways with Cox when R&B gadfly Gorgeous George urged him to join an R&B package tour. I started traveling around, playing around the South, Hendricks recalled. After a couple of months there was a soul package coming into town with Sam Cooke, Solomon Burke, Jackie Wilson, Hank Ballard, B.B. King, and Chuck Jackson. I got a little job playing in the backup band. I learned an awful lot of guitar, picking behind all of those names every night. After that, I traveled all over the states, playing in different groups. Oh God, I can't remember all their names. I used to join a group and quit them so fast. There I was, playing in this top 40 R&B hit parade package with patent leather shoes and hairdo combined. But when you're running around starving on the road, you play almost anything. I didn't hear any guitar players doing anything new, and I was bored out of my mind. I learned how not to get an R&B band together. The trouble was, too many leaders didn't want to pay anybody. Guys would get fired in the middle of the highway because they were talking too loud on the bus, or the leader owed them too much money, something like that. Though he'd succeeded in moving beyond Nashville, Jimmy consistently looked back on this time disdainfully. Bad pay, lousy living, and getting burned. That was them days. Yikes. Hendricks arrived eventually in Harlem, New York City, with virtually nothing to show for his musical exploits to date. He had only begun to showcase his emerging instrumental skills and had yet to demonstrate any ability as a composer or lead vocalist. Finding himself outside of the parameter of the tight-knit, insular Harlem music community, Hendricks was forced to begin anew, making connections and finding work. Worse still, he was broke and teetering on the brink of homelessness. In direct contrast to his depleted finances, Hendricks was full of fierce determination and entered an amateur contest at the fabled Apollo Theater, taking the $25 first prize. I dug playing at the Apollo Theater, Hendricks said later. So I stayed up there, starved up there, for 2 or 3 weeks. I'd get a gig once every 12th of never. I lived in very miserable circumstances. sleeping among garbage cans between them tall tenements was hell. Rats running all across your chest. Cockroaches stealing your last candy bar from your very pockets. I even tried to eat orange peel and tomato paste. See what I'm talking about. Flat broke and with few options at his disposal, Hendrix met Thane Pridgen, a figure in the Harlem scene. At a club, a strong, beautiful woman, Thane was a diva of the Harlem scene, admired by men and women alike. Although not a musician herself, she dated luminaries such as Otis Redding and Little Willie John. Pridgen and Hendrix enjoyed an immediate connection. The two shared a love for each other and music and spent hours together listening to favorites from her mother's deep collection of blues 45s and 78s. She would later say that Hendrix would sit, transfixed, playing and singing to the likes of Anna Lee by Elmore James, lifting the needle back over passages he loved over and over again. Pridgen was struck by Hendrix's knowledge and understanding of these artists and their music. She also understood the guitarist's struggle to find steady work in Harlem and quickly intervened on his behalf. Through a mutual friend, she secured Hendrix an audition with the Isley Brothers. He made a positive impression and earned a position in the IB Specials. That was their backing group. It was during this time with the Isley Brothers that Jimmy attracted the attention of Sue Records chief Juggy Murray. Murray had achieved national prominence for the independent label with breakout singles like A Fool in Love by Ike and Tina Turner and Baby Washington's That's How Heartaches Are Made. King Curtis and I were out of with a couple of dates, Murray said of the first time he and the great R&B saxophonist saw Hendrix. We went to Small's Paradise where they always had music. The Isley Brothers were there and Hendrix was playing guitar with them. I'd never seen this guitar player with the Isley Brothers before, but he was playing the guitar with his teeth, behind his back, and everything. He was just amazing, a hell of a guitar player. So after the break, I approached him, gave him my card. Later, he came down to the office and I signed him to an artist and management contract. Well, let's play a track of Jimmy with the Isley Brothers around this time. This is called Move On Over and Let Me Dance.
I know you like to dance, but give somebody else a chance. I'd like to express myself. Get back, you're ruining my health. Oh, move over. Let me dance. I need some room so I can really, really work out now. Oh, but if you don't move over, then I can't dance. Show you what it's all about now. Oh, but you gotta get back. Are you on the wrong track? You gotta learn how to relax. Oh, get off of my back. Move over. Oh, let me dance. If it's all the same to you, do what the other folks do. Don't be so nasty. Just move over. Oh, let me dance. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean you no harm. You still refuse. You got a nasty attitude. But I paid my dues just like you. I wanna do my thing too. So move over. Why can't you dance someplace else?
telling you, I never heard these Isley Brothers tracks with Jimi Hendrix until I started doing this research, and they're pretty cool songs. And Jimi sounds great already. You can tell that there's something going on. Well, we were talking about how Jimi had met somebody who was thinking about signing him. What was his name? Murray. Anyway, after I signed Jimi, I had him up to the studio a couple of times. The problem was, how do you make a hit with a guitar player? Hendrix was different from Ike Turner. He wasn't a jazz guitar player. He was a rhythm and blues player who could also do rock. How do you get a hit with that? It's all about making hits. It's not about how great somebody can play. We tried a couple of different things, but nothing worked. There's a track around this time by a group called Buddy and Stacy that I can't find the recording of, but it's available on YouTube if you look for it. It's a video, I guess, a film of Jimi Hendrix performing with Buddy and Stacy on guitar. I was going to play that right now from the YouTube, right from YouTube. It's called Shotgun. In that video, man, Jimi is by far the coolest person. And it's hard to see because he's standing exactly in back of the two singers doing the Junior Walker tune, you know, singing the song Shotgun. Whenever they bend over in their dance routine, you can see Jimi popping up in the background with his left-hand guitar, upside-down left-hand guitar, doing what he does. Pretty cool if you want to find it. That's Buddy and Stacy performing Shotgun. You can see it on YouTube. Now, oh, I don't know how I could have forgotten the manager's name, Juggy. I mean, that's pretty unique name. So Jimmy's now manager, Juggy Murray, decided to turn his attention to other artists in his stable. And Jimi continued, in the meantime, playing with the Isley Brothers. Of course, all of his stints as a guitarist for hire, his tenure with the Isley Brothers was perhaps the most stable. He chafed at having to wear uniforms and replicate the same set exactly the same way night after night. But there were brief glimpses of light, as unlike previous groups with whom he toured, the Isley Brothers accorded him the opportunity to record with them. The raw, blistering solo Hendrix provided to Testify, that's the song title, is a superb example of burgeoning talent. Nonetheless, Hendrix did soon grow restless and left the group in the fall of 1964. This is an amazing track. Here is the Isley Brothers with that track, Testify. Jimmy is hot on this one.
Where's Testify?
Track one.
Oh. There we go.
I'm a freak for music. It's in my soul. I can't help it if it moves down to my toes. I said I'm a witness. I'm here to testify. I want to tell y'all about it. Shadows in my feet. I can't keep still, baby. I feel the beat. Oh, it's in my soul. It's in my soul, y'all. It's in my soul. Oh, I wanna testify. You can't knock it if you haven't tried it. Don't be ashamed to let it all hang out. If it's in your soul.
The reason for that fade in there is that was like a part one, part two sort of a thing as a single. It's the Isley Brothers, Testify, and Jimmy was obviously incredibly hot as a guitar player during his time with the Isleys. Now, I wanted to play another A-side and B-side by a guy named Don Covey. And this is a strange coincidence because Heidi just was looking up, you know, through the internet And she says, oh, look at this picture. It's a picture of Jimmy with Mick Jagger. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I'm going to be talking about Mick Jagger in any minute, just this next break. Oh, by the way, speaking of break, 90.3 WHPC, WHPC HD is the station. The show is American Hit Radio. And I want to mention the website. Well, we've actually covered the Isley Brothers in this series a way back. And if you're interested in hearing, it was only one show. I think we did the whole Isleys in just 1 hour show.
Impossible.
Right? Can you imagine that? But if you check the website out, you can go check out, look up the Isley Brothers on AmericanHitNetwork.com. Or just search for American Hit Radio. And you'll see there's a whole slew of stuff. And there's a channel for the Isley Brothers, and it's got the one show in it. Anyway, that being said, Don Covey cut this record with a song called Can't Stay Away and another song called Mercy, Mercy. Never really was a big hit. But what's interesting about it is that the Rolling Stones eventually covered it. And it became really well known because of the Rolling Stones version of Mercy, Mercy. Well, they got it from the Don Covey recording, and that's Jimi Hendrix playing guitar on the Don Covey recording. So we'll play them both back to back, starting with Mercy, Mercy, and then we'll play the B-side, Can't Stay Away.
stand up tonight and testify. I caught the bus to New York City. But when we got as far as Baltimore, seemed like to me I could hear my darling just calling me. So sweet. It seemed like she was calling with a whole lot of soul. And it sounds something like this.
Jimi Hendrix as the main guitarist. And you know that track from the Rolling Stones. Now you can hear it with Jimi Hendrix if you pick up the Don Covey version. Well, anyway, next Jimmy played with Little Richard, although the arrangement was brief and turbulent. The flamboyant Richard was on the downside of a storied career by that period, and he had little tolerance for what he viewed as breaches of his authority. Hendrix ran afoul of Richard's strict dress code almost from the start. Richard also considered Hendrix's backline gyrations to be an effort to draw the spotlight from the fading star. I played with Little Richard for about 5 or 6 months, Hendrix recalled. I worked with him all over America, finally landing in Los Angeles, where I had enough of Richard. He wouldn't let me wear frilly shirts on stage. He had another meeting over my hairstyle. I said I wasn't going to cut my hair for nobody. If our shoelaces were two types, different colors, we'd get fined $5. So, we're going to continue with this with Jimmy and some of his pre-fame recordings next week. But we'll leave you with two tracks by featuring Jimi Hendrix with Little Richard, starting with Dancing All Over the World and I Don't Know What You Got, But It's Got Me. That wasn't so bad a start. We'll pick this up next Friday. Thanks, folks. Bye-bye.
you if I only could. Baby, I don't know what you got. Honey, I don't know what you got, but it's got me. I believe it's got me. You're not very much to look at, but you know just where it's at. You don't have one thing in dime, still I can't leave you behind. Baby, I don't know what you got. Honey, I don't know what you got, but it's got me. I'm telling you, it's got me. What's going on? And I look at my friend because I'm innocent, and my friend look at me and say, Richard, you don't know what's going on. I got something to tell you. And look what my friend tell me. This is what he say to me. Now you cheat on me. I know it's got me. Listen, I gave you all the money I had in the bank. Not one time did you say thanks. But baby, I don't know what you got. Honey, I think I don't know what you got. Sometimes it makes me cry. Sometimes